Good morning, everyone. And again, happy Mother's Day. I hope it's okay with you that I don't do a traditional Mother's Day message. And actually, I haven't heard one in so long, I wouldn't even know what it sounds like. But I do want to shout out. I do know that I'm a mom, I'm a grandma, and I know how difficult this all-encompassing job of being a parent is. In the early years, you think it's tough, and then the teen years come, and you want to die. But instead of focusing exclusively on moms, I'm going to take this opportunity while I have the mic, which I just love this, that we get to come up and say what we want to say, to explain. Now, this is going to sound boring, but I promise when I get a little further on, it's not going to be as boring as it sounds. To explain why the Bible has become more interesting and more important to me than ever before, and maybe help you too discover how very interesting this ancient literature truly is. And my plan is to use the stories of women in the Bible to do this on this Mother's Day. So here we go. I also, unfortunately for all of you, I think this is the longest message I've ever had, and it has the most slides, so everybody should give Becky a hand of round of applause afterwards, or now, even better. Yeah. So here we go. I was a classics major in college, and that means I studied ancient Greek and Roman civilizations and other ancient civilizations. And as a requirement of my major, I had to learn Greek and Latin, and I'm not bragging because I've forgotten actually all of it. But we had to demonstrate our proficiency by translating ancient texts. And that's when I realized that our perspectives, our assumptions, and our experiences greatly affect how we interpret language. What word we choose in our language to replace a word that is an ancient language. How many of you speak more than one language? Oh, good. That's pretty good odds for America, because there's a really great travel joke. What do you call a person who speaks two languages? What do you call a person who speaks one language?
American. An American.
All right. But those of you who speak more than one language, you know the difficulty it is sometimes in translating. There's idioms, there's sense, there's meaning. It's really, really tough. So that's one problem. Another thing that impacts our translations is our knowledge or our lack of knowledge of the cultures that produce those texts. And you need to know a lot more than just the definitions of words and the tenses of words. And this affects all translators everywhere, and it's what makes translating the Bible, or what makes translating in general so difficult. But it's especially difficult in translating the Bible, where we don't know as much about the everyday world that the Bible writers over the centuries were writing about. And it also affects modern writers. Those people who write our commentaries and our study notes in your Bibles. Who's got a study Bible at home that has lots of notes in it? Okay. And it affects us as readers, even when we're reading the Bible in our own language, because each one of us brings our cultural lens, our gender lens, our socioeconomic lens, and what we've been taught in previous Bible studies or from previous sermons. And even our own life experiences affect our understanding of what is on the page. And for most of us, we also come with really big holes in our understanding of ancient cultures. Until recently, the majority of Bibles produced here in the United States have had Western, mostly white, highly educated, which also means affluent, nearly 100% male, and I'm assuming straight male, teams of translators, commentators, and writers of study notes. And therefore, those study notes, the commentaries, and even the translation choices reflect that perspective. And also their religious affiliation affects translation, commentaries, and study notes. Catholic Bibles are different from Protestant Bibles, and there is a huge variation within Protestant Bibles depending on the team's religious leanings. Now, please, please, please don't hear me saying that I have something against highly educated, affluent, straight, white men. I am not saying that. What I am saying is that we would all benefit from a variety of perspectives on the teams that produce Bibles, a variety in gender, ethnic, socioeconomic, and theological differences. Imagine how our faith might look if we included people of color, our queer brothers and sisters, and the voices of the marginalized in shaping our understanding of Scripture. It is slowly happening, and for that I am very thankful. And that is one of the reasons why the Bible is more interesting to me than ever before. It is a library of different voices and different perspectives. And now we have a variety of resources and perspectives available to help us make sense of it. The Bible isn't something we have to understand in just one way. We don't have to force it to speak in a consistent voice. We can let it be what it is, a window into this mystery called God. I read something the other day that has become for me a metaphor for reading the Bible, and maybe it will help you too. If you look at a stained glass window from the outside of a building, it's dull. It's almost colorless, kind of like our Bibles before we open them up. But if you step into the building and you look at the window from the inside, it comes alive. It glows. You see how the pieces work together, small bits of glass carefully cut and assembled. You also see flaws and chips, and some of the colors aren't consistent. You might see repairs where something was broken and has been fixed. And yet, it's beautiful. And the more you look at it, the more you notice. Different things jump out at you depending on where you are in the room and how familiar you are with what is being depicted. Sometimes you need help to figure out what you are looking at. Some of the things pictured are weird, especially in medieval stained glass windows. And sometimes, if you are lucky, you look down at yourself and the colored light streaming through the window is shining on you. You become part of the art. That's how I think about the Bible these days. When we look closely at the Bible stories, when we step inside and walk around inside them, they often reveal surprising things and allow us to become part of the story. So today for Mother's Day, we're going to take a look at a few women from Scripture and just see how the light shines differently, and maybe you too will feel it shining on you. So Genesis 2:18, it's not good for man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him. This English word helper has created and continues to create problems for translators and women in the church. Because if we look at the definition of helper, and this is from the Merriam-Webster dictionary, helper, these are the definitions that kill me. One that helps. Okay. And then they clarify it. They say, often a relatively unskilled worker who assists a skilled worker, usually by manual labor. Okay. Synonyms for helper include assistant, aide, apprentice, adjutant, deputy. Right away, we get a sense of hierarchy, don't we? But that word in Hebrew has a completely different meaning. The Hebrew word in the text that we see in our Bibles translated as helper is this word, azer. And this word occurs in the Hebrew Testament 21 times. And of those 21 times, it is used to describe God 16 times. And of those 16 times, the word describes God as one who rescues, as a warrior, as a shield, and that's how it's translated in your Bibles when it's referring to God. It refers to God and the divine help that God provides. And there's no sense of God having a subordinate status because he is an azer for his people. So in my understanding, Eve was never intended to be subordinate. She was as important as Adam. She was necessary for God's unfolding plan. The plan cannot succeed without Eve. And as we look at the stories of other women in the Bible, we will see the varied and important and absolutely necessary roles they played in the unfolding promises and plan of God. And this whole thing is kind of ironic, because when you realize that this passage has been used to justify the subordination of women to men, I went to Bible Gateway, which you all have seen that site, right, where you get Bible okay. And so to check out the various translations of Genesis 2:18, and there were over 40 that they had there, and I found just a few that tried to use language that would give equal status to Adam and Eve. So in the Amplified Bible, it reads, "Then the Lord God said, it's not good for man to be alone. I will make a helper," and then in brackets, "in the sense of a partner or ally, the word does not imply subordinate status, who is right for, is suitable for, corresponds with him." Takes a lot of words to get to the meaning of Azer. And then the International Standard Version is, "It's not good for the man to be alone, so I will make the woman to be an authority corresponding to him." So you see, we don't have a single English word that can capture what the Hebrew word Ezer means. And unfortunately, the English word helper is not helpful. You can see that translators try to be faithful to the text, and yet translators can still be blind to how their own perspectives or how their own faith tradition influences that translation. And that's why diversity in translation teams and teams that put together Bibles has become so important to me. And I've also spent so many years in church settings hearing the Bible interpreted. In just one way. And I need theologians and writers and thinkers who are not like me, who are going to break me out of this pattern. So someone who has shown me a different perspective can enhance our understanding of the text is Dr. Wilda Gaffney. She's a writer, a theologian, and an Episcopal priest. And she's the author of a book, Womanist Midrash, which contains her understanding of various women from the Hebrew Testament. And I highly recommend her work to all of you. So while I have the mic today, I'm going to be talking about Miriam, Moses' older sister, and two other women with what I've gleaned from Dr. Gaffney's book. And then I'm going to finish with a woman from the New Testament. And Dr. Gaffney did not cover this woman, so what you're going to hear is my take on this woman. So the three women I'm going to talk about first from the Hebrew Testament are Shipra, Puah, and Miriam. Three Azers who played very important roles. All three lived in Egypt during Pharaoh's campaign to eliminate the Hebrew population of Egypt via infanticide, the killing of newborns. You may recall that the Hebrews were slaves in Egypt, and the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The Egyptians saw that they were outnumbered by the Hebrews, and they feared an uprising. The Egyptians feared losing power. The text says the slave masters made the Hebrew lives bitter with hard labor in the hope that the Hebrew population would dwindle. But that didn't work. So Pharaoh called the two women who were overseeing the Hebrew Midwife Guild, and he called them into his presence. These two women, Shipra and Puah, were instructed by Pharaoh to tell all the Hebrew midwives to let the girl babies live, but to kill boy babies at birth. But they didn't do what Pharaoh commanded. Can you imagine the courage it took to defy Pharaoh, especially since he knew their names? He knew who they were. They, along with all the other midwives, continued to bring new life into the world, baby girls and baby boys. Pharaoh could not figure out why there were still so many Hebrews. He summoned Shipra and Puah again. "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" Shipra and Puah were so brave, and they were so clever. They lied to Pharaoh, and their lie fed into Pharaoh's hate and prejudice regarding the Hebrews. They said, "Oh, Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like the civilized, genteel Egyptian women. Hebrew women are sturdy and vigorous, and, well, they just give birth before our midwives can get there." And Pharaoh bought the lie because it fed into his view of what the Hebrews were like. And he did not have Shipra or Puah killed. Shipra and Puah were Ezers to their people, necessary, important. Their courage led them to participate in God's unfolding plan. Miriam also appears in Exodus in chapter 2, and she lives sometime after Shipra and Puah. And as I said, she is Moses' older sister. By this time, Pharaoh has changed his tactics. He no longer relied on the Hebrew midwives anymore. Instead, he ordered every Egyptian to throw newborn baby boys into the Nile. Can you imagine how that affected the Hebrew families? The fear that a pregnant slave lived with? The sense that hostile eyes were watching you all the time? Your very ethnicity, religion, and childbearing ability made you a target of the state. And you may find, as I find, parallels to today. Miriam's mother, Jochebed, gave birth to a boy, Moses. She was able to hide him for 3 months, but after that it wasn't possible. Baby boys get louder, don't they, as they get older. She decided to give him a slim chance to survive by placing him in a basket in the Nile River, in an area where high-born Egyptian ladies would sometimes bathe. His mother, Jochebed, knew this was the only chance, remote as it was, for her infant son to survive. Miriam watched from a distance to see what would happen to Moses. Fortunately, it was Pharaoh's daughter who retrieved the baby from the water. And Miriam was there and offered to find a nursemaid for the baby. And the nursemaid, of course, was Jochebed, giving mother and son more time together. Both Miriam and Jochebed put their lives in danger by thwarting Pharaoh's plan, as did the midwives who lied to Pharaoh, and the Hebrew women who opted to give birth unassisted by midwives. And even Pharaoh's own daughter, who drew the infant Moses from the water, defied Pharaoh by raising Moses as her own. And this makes me wonder if there were other Egyptians who thought Pharaoh's plan was repugnant and secretly worked to help the Hebrews. I would like to think so. And at any rate, on this day, there were several Azers at work, partners in God's unfolding plan. Miriam's story continues. You remember that God called Moses to get his people out of Egypt. Lots of drama, plagues before the big event. But then Pharaoh relented. The people packed up and left. But when they reached the sea, they saw that Pharaoh's army was following them. Moses raised his staff, and the Israelites crossed safely, but the sea engulfed Pharaoh's army. Chapter 15 in my study Bible back at home on my desk is titled The Song of Moses and Miriam. And it's a very lengthy song. It's a song that celebrates God's mighty work on behalf of the Hebrews. They sang it after they all crossed over to safety. In my Bible, it says that Moses, and your Bibles too, by the way, in my Bible, it says that Moses led the singing, praising God for saving them. And then my Bible only mentions Miriam, who is also called a prophet, leading the singing in the last verse. But biblical scholars agree that somewhere along the process of forming the Hebrew Bible, Miriam's role in singing this song was minimized and Moses' role was elevated. Because the verses containing the names of Miriam and Moses were most likely reversed by some editor in the past. It is actually Miriam's song, and she's leading the people and mostly the women in singing. Why? because that was the tradition in this culture. The women sang. And elsewhere in the Bible and in the Dead Sea Scrolls and in other ancient texts, it is the women who use the hand drum, who dance, and who sing, not the men. But somewhere along the line, some ancient editors felt that Moses needed to be predominant. And that brings me back to my earlier point. The perspective or the lens of the translator and editor affects how something is translated or edited. Well, Miriam's story continues, and you may remember that the Israelites, and there were thousands of them, wandered in the desert for 40 years. And we think of them as one big group of people. But if you pay attention to the story, if you walk around it and walk with them on the journey, you realize that there were always two different camps on the journey. In the book of Numbers, we learn that Moses was told by God that anyone with a disease or skin issue or who had touched a dead person or a million other things becomes unclean and needs to be sent out of the camp. Sorry, Hillary. Hope they're still in order. And when they become clean again, when they are declared clean again, they can rejoin the main camp. So clearly, always, there was a group of people traveling the same 40-year journey, but who were separated from the main camp. Now think about this for a bit. Women had to leave the main camp and join the unclean camp during their menstrual cycle. If anyone, man or woman or child, had a rash or ulcers or an infected eye, they couldn't come back until they were declared clean. So families would be temporarily broken up, but some were permanently broken up. Because, of course, individuals in both camps hoped they would be reunited, but many realized they were never going to get better, and that they would have to make a new life for themselves in the margins, permanently separated from the main camp, because some conditions can't be healed. And therefore, original family structures fell apart, and new families formed in the unclean camp. It is possible that some were born and died in the unclean camp. If you walk around in this part of the story for any length of time, it's painful to think about. In addition, the light that shines from this particular stained glass window might remind us of events happening in the world today. Continuing a bit more with Miriam, in the book of Numbers, we learn that Aaron and Miriam were upset with Moses. Of course, big brother and big sister were upset with little brother. But they were upset with Moses because they disapproved of the woman he had married. Moses was the baby in the family. The text says that Miriam and Aaron challenged Moses' authority, and because of that, God zapped Miriam with a terrible skin disease. And the skin disease made Miriam unclean, so she was sent to the camp on the margins. Now, there are lots of confusing bits in this story, such as why Miriam was blamed for something both she and Aaron did, and how Aaron avoided punishment for the same offense. But there's also something very interesting that happens. When someone was sent to the outer camp, the journey to the promised land never stopped. Both camps kept moving. But when Miriam was sent to the outer camp, they all stopped. All people in both camps did not move until Miriam was brought back to the main camp. That's how important and valuable Miriam was to them. She was their Azer, their prophet, their rescuer, the one they could not do without. There are so many women in the Bible who served as an Azer, whose courage and belief in God's covenantal promises created a path leading directly to Jesus. Women such as Shipra, Pua, and Miriam, women who I have not talked about and don't have time to talk about on this Sunday morning, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Esther, whose courageous acts were both risky and dangerous for themselves. Think about Jesus' own mother, Mary, saying yes to what God had asked of her, how courageous she was. And then there were the women who fed, funded, and followed Jesus and his disciples and responded positively to the message. Mary Magdalene, Martha, the other Mary, the mother of James and John, Salome, and many, many more. And also the women we see in the epistles, Priscilla, Lydia, Phoebe, and many unnamed women. Jesus had so many positive interactions with women, and now I want to take a close look at one of them. So using the idea of walking around in a story, let's take a look at the unnamed woman, the Samaritan woman, from John's Gospel. But first, a brief history lesson. The land we call Israel was conquered many times in its history. So, the first time, it was the Assyrians. And they came and they conquered northern Israel, not the southern part of Judah. They conquered the part where the 10 tribes live. And they exiled the 10 tribes. And then the Babylonians came and they conquered Judah. The remaining two tribes of Judah were taken to Babylon. And then the Persians conquered the Babylonians. And it was the Persians who allowed the two tribes to return. And then what's next? Okay, then the Greeks conquer the Persians, and they rule of all of Israel's land. And then when they go by the wayside, the Hasmoneans start ruling. And those were elite Jews who were ruling with Greek and then Roman permission. And then finally, in Jesus' time, it's Roman rule of everything, everywhere. So I'm going to retrace a few of the steps here. But thanks to David and Solomon, Israel was once one big kingdom, but it broke apart after Solomon's death. The 10 tribes formed the northern kingdom of Israel. The remaining two tribes became Judah in the south. And in the north, the kings allowed the worship of foreign gods and goddesses. And the kings made alliances with foreign nations. And so then this happens. The northern kingdom was conquered first by the Assyrians. And then the Jewish people, who were the 10 of the 12 tribes living there, were taken away. And then the Assyrians repopulated the land with captives from other lands that they had conquered. And these captives, too, do not know Yahweh, and they are people who worship other gods. And that's why the Jews of Jesus' time, which was many centuries later, viewed the Samaritans as not really Jewish, and why the Samaritans had to worship on Mount Gerizim and not in Jerusalem, and why there were really, really, really bad feelings between Jews and Samaritans. And then later, of course, the southern kingdom also fell. So here's the story from John's Gospel, famously known as the woman at the well. And I'm using the Bible translation, which is more of a paraphrase, called The Voice. And for several reasons. It was created so that we, as readers, can walk around in the story a bit. A varied team of men and women worked on it. It uses inclusive language. It translates words by their meaning, not just word for word. That's that problem we had with the word helper. And it retains the poetry and lyricism of the original text, and it also amplifies easily misunderstood text. So on these slides, the underlined sections are the study notes that are included within the text of the Amplified Bible. And the italicized text is the amplification they use to clarify the meaning. So here we go. The picture was becoming clear to the Pharisees that Jesus had gained a following much larger than that of John the Baptist, the wandering prophet. Now he could see that the Pharisees were beginning to plot against him. This was because his disciples were busy ritually cleansing many new disciples through baptism. He chose to leave Judea, where most Pharisees lived, and return to a safer location in Galilee. This was a trip that would take them through Samaria. And now here's a study note inserted. For Jews in Israel, Samaria is a place to be avoided. Before Solomon's death 1,000 years earlier, the regions of Samaria and Judea were part of a united Israel. After the rebellion that divided the kingdom, Samaria became a hotbed of idol worship. The northern kings made alliances that corrupted the people by introducing foreign customs and strange gods. They even had the nerve to build a temple to the true God on Mount Gerizim to rival the one in Jerusalem. By the time the 12 are traveling with Jesus, it has long been evident that the Samaritans have lost their way. By marrying outsiders, they have polluted the land. Israel's Jews consider them to be half-breeds, mongrels, and the Jews know to watch out for them or else be bitten by temptation. In a small Samaritan town known as Sychar, Jesus and his entourage stopped to rest at the historic well that Jacob gave his son Joseph. It was about noon when Jesus found a spot to sit close to the well while the disciples ventured off to find provisions. From his vantage, he watched as a Samaritan woman approached to draw some water. Unexpectedly, he spoke to her. "Jesus, would you draw water and give me a drink?" "Woman, I cannot believe that you, a Jew, would associate with me, a Samaritan woman, much less to ask me to give you a drink." Study note, Jews, you see, have no dealings with Samaritans. Also, a man never approaches a woman like this in public. Jesus is breaking accepted social barriers with this confrontation. "Jesus, you don't know the gift of God or who is asking you for a drink of this water from Jacob's well, because if you did, you would have asked him for something greater, and he would have given you living water." "Woman, sir, you sit by this deep well, a thirsty man without a bucket in sight. Where does this living water come from? Are you claiming superiority to our father Jacob, who labored long and hard to dig and maintain this well so that he could share clean water with his sons, grandchildren, and cattle?" "Jesus, drink this water, and your thirst is quenched only for a moment. You must return to this well again and again. I offer water that will become a wellspring within you that gives life throughout eternity. You will never be thirsty again." "Woman, please, sir, give me some of this water so I'll never be thirsty and never again have to make the trip to this well." "Jesus, then bring your husband to me." "Woman, I do not have a husband. Jesus, technically you are telling the truth, but you have had 5 husbands and are currently living with a man you are not married to." "Woman, sir, it is obvious to me that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped here on this mountain, but your people say that Jerusalem is the only place for all to worship. Which is it?" "Jesus, woman, I tell you that neither is so. Believe this, a new day is coming, in fact, it's already here, when the importance will not be placed on the time and place of worship, but on the truthful hearts of worshipers. You worship what you don't know, while we worship what we do know. For God's salvation is coming through the Jews. The Father is spirit, and he is seeking followers whose worship is sourced in truth and deeply spiritual as well. Regardless of whether you are in Jerusalem or on this mountain, if you do not seek the Father, then you do not worship." "Woman, these mysteries will be made clear by he who is promised, the Anointed One." "Jesus, the Anointed is speaking to you. I am the one you have been looking for." The disciples returned to him and gathered around him in amazement that he would openly break their customs by speaking to this woman, but none of them would ask him what he was looking for or why he was speaking with her. The woman went back to the town, leaving her water pot behind. She stopped men and women on the streets and told them what had happened. "Woman, I met a stranger who knew everything about me. Come and see for yourselves. Can he be the Anointed One?" And a crowd came out of the city and approached Jesus. I know that was lengthy. Did you know that this is the longest conversation as recorded in the Gospels that Jesus had with anyone, male or female? The longest conversation. In all the Gospels, Jesus has many interactions with women, but the ones in John's Gospel, to me, are very interesting. Now, in past Bible studies, not here, when I was sitting at the feet of older, wiser women, the give and take about this passage often went like this. Notice how the woman comes at noon. She's by herself during the hottest part of the day, not in the cool of the morning when it was usual for women to draw water and chat with each other. And the conclusion usually drawn was that this means this woman is a bit sketchy, most likely because she has loose morals based on the fact that she's been married so many times and the one she's living with is not her husband. Married 5 times. Then a whole lot of speculation went into whether her 5 husbands died or was she divorced 5 times. If she were a widow, did she have to keep marrying brothers of the first husband because that was a custom at the time? Or did the 5 different husbands divorce her because she was so difficult or kept burning dinner or asked deep theological questions for which they had no answer and she made them feel dumb? I don't know. But None of these speculations ever took note of the fact that this story appears in the Gospel of John. And none of these speculations ever took note of the fact of Samaria's history, or took note of the fact that John was an amazing writer who deliberately crafted this story and all of the stories in his gospel to bring out something very important. So, this is all on me. If you don't worry about, well, never mind. If you don't like it, I'm the problem, is basically what I'm going to say. So when I walk around this story, I bring with me my love of history, my interest in how writers craft stories, and all the many things I've been learning from the Bible Project, the Bible from Normal People, all of the amazing podcasts from a variety of people who are not like me, plus all the other readily available resources that we have today that makes the Bible more interesting than ever. So here we go. John's gospel is very different from the other three gospels. John uses lots of symbolism, and he has layers and layers and layers of meaning within his gospel, within his stories. For example, this story, the woman at the well. Jesus meets the woman at a well, but not just any well. John calls it Jacob's well. It was at this well, way, way back in Genesis, that Abraham's servant met Rebekah and arranged for her to become the wife of Isaac. Isaac, who was the son promised by God to Abraham. Isaac, the son, was promised that he would make, or Isaac, the son, promised to Abraham that would make Abraham's descendants a great nation. Thank you. I'm a little tongue-tied there. This is also the very same well where Jacob, who was the son of Isaac, first laid eyes on Rachel. Rachel and her sister Leah became the mothers of Jacob's 12 sons. The 12 sons were the patriarchs of the 12 tribes. The well in Samaria is the beginning of the 12 tribes of Israel. And mentioning this well would also remind Jewish readers of fun things like betrothals and weddings. Because this is where, connecting that story to Abraham and Isaac, betrothals begin at wells in the Old Testament. And thinking about betrothals connects the reader to an earlier story in John, Jesus at the wedding at Cana. John is telling us something good is going to happen at this well. Something about God's unfolding plan is going to happen here. Something about his promises to his people is going to happen here. Something great like a wedding, a new beginning, a different kind of betrothal. So the well is important, but the time of day is also important. It's noon. It's bright. There's lots of light. And in John's gospel, light symbolizes understanding. If we compare this passage that happens in daylight with an earlier passage in John that happens in darkness, we'll get some clarification. Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night. Remember that? He, a son of Israel, asks questions, yet he leaves confused. This woman meets Jesus during the day, asks questions, and she leaves with understanding. And what about all those husbands? Well, John has already introduced the idea that important events in the history of Israel have occurred at this well. And maybe, just maybe, when Jesus mentions the five husbands, he isn't actually talking about men. I think it is a clever way for Jesus to tell her, I know your history. I know your land's history. I see you. Because maybe this is what he's talking about. Husband number one, the Assyrians. Husband number two, the Babylonians. Husband number three, the Persians. Husband number four, the Greeks. Husband number five, the Hasmoneans, and the husband you have to deal with right now is the Romans. You've had five different empires overrun and control you, and now the empire you have to live with is the Romans. And it actually makes her questions make more sense, and it helps her to see that he's sympathetic to her history, this unfortunate history of Samaria, where they become the outliers of the Jews. Jesus is presenting himself as a better bridegroom than the empires that have controlled them all. It's as if he is betrothing himself to her as a representative of the Samaritans, inviting them all back, welcoming them, telling them they belong, and reminding them that they are part of God's unfolding plan. When she runs back to her village shouting, "Come and see, this Jewish man gets us. Could this be the Christ?" she becomes an Azer, part of the divine plan, that we all belong to God. So these are just a few of the stories that make the Bible more interesting than ever to me. Stepping inside the stories, I allow myself to think about them in new ways, see things I've missed before. My view of the Bible has been expanded and enriched by writers and theologians who have completely different perspectives than mine, different than the ones I have always heard. Yes, this book is hard to understand. It's weird. It's ancient. When we try to subdue it and make it say what we think it should say, or when we treat it like a rule book, or when we think our one job as a believer is to stay holy and sinless, or when we use it to condemn others, or when we think we have to save people from hell, then we miss the immense, all-encompassing, life-giving, grace-filled love the Creator has for all of us. We miss the light shining on us from the window. Our Azer of the skies, the divine Creator, is always asking us to step into this beautiful, confusing, and relational stained glass story of his unending love for us. All right? Okay. Hillary and Chris, come on up. We're going to have communion in a moment. And what I also want to say is that there is a flow, a story through the Bible, some facts. Always in the Bible, Yahweh, and this is a God of tenderness and compassion, slow to anger, rich in kindness, and abounding in faithfulness, which is what communion represents. This bread and juice represents God's love for us and the lengths that God is willing to go to make himself known to us. So the ushers can come up. And in a minute, the band will start playing. And when you're ready, you can come up. And everyone's welcome, please, everyone. And if for some reason you just don't want to get up, but you want communion, raise your hand and I'll bring it to you. But when you're ready, come up the inner aisles, take the bread and the juice, return to your seats using the outer aisles. If you mess the steps up in that little dance, no worry. Sit down, and when you're ready, when you feel ready, take the cup and the bread. I said earlier today when we gave communion to the people that were so busy up here that they can't take it with us, that we call communion a sacrament, and a sacrament means that in some way, some mysterious way, completely unknown to us, we don't know how, God is more present at that moment. And so we come to communion as a community, acknowledging our dependence on God and on each other.